Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to CSIS. It's a real pleasure to have you here with us today for what I'm certain will be a most interesting panel looking at the Summit of the Americas process, Port of Spain and beyond, behind the scenes of the OAS, looking especially at the work of the summit process and what lies ahead. We are limited by time, so I won't go into any kind of a formal introduction. The members of the panel I'll introduce one by one before they speak, and I won't list their many important biographical points because you have them here. We'll begin, and we won't be following the list of speakers exactly, because Ambassador Shannon must leave after making his presentation, so he will speak second. We'll begin with His Excellency Ambassador Albert Ramdean, the Assistant Secretary General of the Organization of American States. And again, please excuse the rapidity with which we begin, but time is of the essence right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter, and I will help you, and I help Tom also, by being as quick as we can to facilitate his early departure. But first of all, I want to thank CSIS for organizing this event. I think it's timely. It's important to reflect on such an important meeting which took place just 2 weeks ago. So it's very timely. I want to specifically thank Peter DeChasso for his leadership in this. It's all these series of events surrounding the Americas on the critical issues. I think it's very important that institutions like CSIS provide us with a platform, but also the audience to listen and to contribute on these critical issues. And I should include in that Johanna Mendelssohn Foreman for your continuous dialogue with the OAS on many issues from Haiti to trade and others. Thank you very much. As I'm thanking and congratulating, let me congratulate the government and people of Trinidad and Tobago with the summit which took place. It was a unique gathering of 34, all the 34 political leaders in one period, in one location, and you know what it means when 34 of those leaders come together at the same time, in the same room, and the same moment. It's a very specific dynamic, and we hope that we all can share with you some of the that atmospherics, as Peter Hakim calls it. I want to give special recognition, and I repeat myself for those who have heard me speak before on this, special recognition to the Prime Minister, the Honorable Patrick Manning, for his sterling leadership. Because without that kind of engagement of the chairman, I think many things could have happened. But I think his firm commitment, his strong management of the meeting and setting the criteria under which he wanted to chair and see results helped a lot in mobilizing this kind of outcome which we have today. As Prime Minister Harper stated in his closing press conference, the expectation of tension, of conflict, was not met. And that was one of the most important conclusions or benefits of this meeting. We can say a lot about the Summit of the Americas process in general, and certainly about the Fifth Summit of the Americas. We can analyze it. I'm not going to do that simply because we don't have enough time for that. But I want to highlight a couple of issues. One is that we have to understand, I think, the context in which the summit took place. I think a year ago, when we started with the preparations of the summit, nobody expected it to be of such a historical significance, if we can speak about that today. Because simply, you know, what has happened since then? Nobody thought that we would have a financial crisis and that there would be a need for pragmatism, not for ideology, but for a pragmatic approach to problems. We had the problems on the food security, the energy problems, the environmental challenges, the issue of security, crime and violence in the hemisphere. And those continue. Those did not go away. Today we have the swine flu, the health issues. So the hemisphere has seen a continuous battle with challenges, with problems. And I think this is something which has changed the tone of summitry and the way leaders go into these meetings. A year ago we did not know, at least I did not know, that President Obama would have been elected. That created also a dynamic a whole range of different expectations from those who say wait and see, others who say we'll give him the benefit of the doubt, and others have very high expectations. But it created a different environment going into this summit with a new leader in the U.S. administration. So these are two things which I think need to be taken on board in terms of why this meeting became much more pragmatic and less ideological. And one thing which has changed over the past couple of years, which we have to take into account also, is that the political landscape in the Western Hemisphere has clearly changed with the election of new leaders, new leadership styles, new views, new perspectives on development, on economy, on societies, on foreign relations. All these things have created a different scenario in the Western Hemisphere. So this summit suddenly became critically important for leaders to meet and to engage among themselves. And that is, I think, the starting point of the summit when we see 34 leaders meet each other at the opening ceremony. Now, what happened since then, again, very briefly, very quickly, in my view, having been in the room, is that the ambiance, the body language from the beginning showed something positive. You can go into a summit with different attitudes, a positive one, a positive agenda, you know, willing to divide, willing to be of conflict, or be very pragmatic and go into a summit with a positive agenda, trying to help, trying to build unity and a collectivity. I think the latter prevailed. What we saw from the beginning in the inauguration, and it continued in the plenary sessions, in the luncheon and in the retreat. Okay, in the luncheon and the retreat, I wasn't present, but from what I have heard, that the same tone, the same kind of demeanor continued among the leaders. There was, starting with President Cristina Kirchner, a presentation of views and perspective with clarity. Very clear, very direct, very focused, and without hiding any sentiments or objectives. And that is what you expect from leaders to do, to be frank, to be direct, to be, you know, forceful in their positioning. And that is exactly what happened not only with President Kirchner, but all the others who followed, all the four others who followed. Different in tones but and content, but strong in their conviction of what they were saying and trying to convince. But key in all this presentation was that the perspectives were presented not in a conflicting manner. We were very cordial, almost friendly, you would think, almost friendly, with an undertone of, please hear me out, listen to me. And I think that's also an environment which you want to have, not one which is trying to incite division, but trying to convince. And I think that helped a lot in terms of how the meeting went over the following 2 days. I think we can talk a lot about this summit in terms of, you know, the positive nature of it. And some may not believe that that is useful, but I personally believe that you start with some positive elements. You start with leaders willing to engage, willing to dialogue, willing to listen to each other. You can easily not have that, and then nothing else follows. But you need the starting point. We may not have everything what needs to be followed at this point in time, but at least we have a starting point of a willingness, a political will, to engage with each other. And I think in a couple of years when we're going to evaluate again, maybe in CSIS, this issue about the importance of this summit, I think people may speak about the situation before TNT and after TNT. You know, that is the marking point. That's the importance I attach to this summit as a watershed. I know that we have time for question and answers later on, and I want to raise some of the issues later on. But what I would like to say in terms of where we are at this point, we have two documents, and in my view, those two documents are useful documents. Certainly the document which came out signed by the Prime Minister on behalf of all the leaders is, in my view, a binding document for all countries. The arguments made before not to adopt the document, the summit, the Declaration of Commitment of Trinidad and Tobago, those arguments, I think, in the course of those 2 days, faded away. They don't exist anymore. The issue of Cuba was addressed. The issue of the financial crisis was addressed. So in the closing statement of the chair. So we believe that from our perspective, the Declaration of Commitment and the Statement of the Chair should be seen as useful documents in follow-up to the summit. And I think anybody who wants to dispute that should move away from this pre-summit environment in which the documents came to be. You have to think about the environment which has been created after the summit and then operate in accordance with that. That is what I'm looking at. And I think in that case, nobody should have any difficulty with it. Speaking about after the summit, I want to raise a couple of issues in the question and answers issue session, but I think a couple of things need to be done. One is we need to move from words to deeds. We need action, because I personally don't believe in declaration. We have too many of those. We know the mandates. I think every country knows what needs to be done. What we need now is action to implement, effective implementation. You don't do implementation without the proper coordinating structure, without understanding the role of the domestic authorities and the multilateral institutions. You're not capable of implementing if you don't have money. Funding is critically important, and that has been a weak point of the summit process from the beginning. Now, we need to know which summit mandates are already executed and which not. So I think maybe it's time to do an extensive analysis of what has been done and achieved so far by country and through the multilateral institutions. In terms of financing, I think the IDB should have really special financing windows for the summit mandates, and those should translate into the Caribbean Development Bank and the other sub-regional development banks in Central America and South America. So implementation and financing. Now, in terms of the political outlook, this political momentum of dialogue, this positive forward-looking approach which has been created, needs to continue. And I think San Pedro Sula, when we have the next General Assembly, may be another moment to continue this vision. Maybe the ministers of finance meeting in Chile, when we discuss the impact and the mitigation of the impact of the financial crisis, may be another moment. But this positive element needs to continue at all levels, not only at the level of the leaders, but certainly downwards in the bodies of the Inter-American system. The third point in terms of follow-up is how do we institutionalize this summit process in the existing dialogue structure of the Americas. I'll make just 5 points there quickly. I think we should designate the OAS as a secretariat for the summit operationally, because I think we do have the experience and the expertise to prepare annually as we prepare for the General Assembly. Secondly, we should transform every 3 years the OAS General Assembly into a Summit of Americas. Thirdly, I think through this process of facilitating the summit through the OAS, it would facilitate also a process of translating summit mandates in the work program of the institutions of the Joint Summit Working Group, as well as of the ministerials, which already take place under the auspices, most of them under the auspices of the OAS. Fourthly, I think the OAS can facilitate a multilateral preparatory process, similarly as we do for the Annual General Assembly meeting, again with the added benefit of a substantive input from the ministerial meetings which take place at technical level. And then designate the existing Special Committee of Summits Management, which is currently chaired by Ambassador Glenda Morian Phillips from Trinidad and Tobago, as the principal venue to monitor, evaluate, and implement the summit mandates and report and receive reports from member states. Those are in terms of the institutionalization. We can talk about this in the question and answer session again. Two other suggestions, back-to-back meetings of the OAS and the IDB annually, so that you get a connection between a political mandate and a financial mandate, which is another weak point of the process at this point. Political mandates, when leaders sign this document, well, in this case one, but when all of them would have signed it, it goes back to the countries, remains in the political departments most of the time, does not go to the technical ministries, does not translate into national programming. As a consequence, little is being implemented. That needs to be reconnected. There is a responsibility not only for the Inter-American institutions, but for the national authorities. And this is, again, another weak point, that the implementation at the domestic level has been very weak. And in absence of structure, which we have seen, I believe that if every country would be mandated, not only mandated, but possibly, mandated to have a national executive secretary for summit mandate implementation, it would help connect within the national authority, the national territory, all the different technical ministries, as well as the financing the implementation, and the reporting to the OAS. Now, those are some of the suggestions I want to make in terms of the follow-up to the summit, because that is going to be the most critical element, is the follow-up. How do we make this positive movement become normal reality? I have not spoken about three issues, which I'd like to address later on. One is on Cuba, where I believe that a debate has started and it will not go away. At the same time, we have to be realistic and inclusive in our approach, especially in terms of timing and consultations. We need a step-by-step incremental approach. I don't think anything else can work. We know that there are bilateral communication between Cuba and the USA. Maybe they should get more space to work that out. But the principled and measured approach is something which should be always underlying any effort, principled and measured, in terms of what has happened since 1962 in the whole Western Hemisphere, is a strengthened democratic framework, the issue of human rights, the issue of governance, the issue of elections. We cannot forget those things. Simply, we cannot forget it, because those are the achievements from the past 30, 40 years. So while we should not forget 1962, we should not forget also what has been achieved so far. And, of course, we need to hear from the Cuban government and its people itself what they want. Personally, I find that too many people speak for Cuba instead of Cuba themselves. In terms of the OAS, we can only assist, and we have only been able to be successful, and I think you all will agree that we were very successful, that we can only assist if we have a mandate to communicate, to engage. And at this point, that mandate is not there. So this may be something which member states may want to look at. How do we get the Inter-American system involved, even in the non-political areas? Communication, education, culture, agriculture, natural disasters, areas where I believe the country needs assistance. I want to close by saying this. Apart from member states, we should not forget that the summit was owned by other institutions in pre-summit activities. The youth, the young people, the civil society, the private sector, and the labor movement. And I was very pleased to see that congressional delegations from different countries were also present, because it's critically important to get the legislative behind this implementation process. I thank you very much, and I look forward to questions.
Thank you, Ambassador Ramdeen. Assistant Secretary Shannon.
Thank you very much, Peter, and again, I'm very sorry. When I accepted the invitation, I didn't expect that I was going to be instructed to go to a meeting shortly. So I'm going to be very short, but please, I apologize for having to depart so quickly. I want to start by congratulating the government of Trinidad and Tobago for a great summit. Ambassador, your government did a wonderful job. And what I wanted to do very briefly is just talk about, from the point of view of the United States, what we think the summit means for the hemisphere, what we think it means for the United States, and then also what it means for the world at large. Very briefly, as far as the hemisphere goes, I think the first and most important point is that the summit process is alive and well. And I think a lot of that credit goes to the government of Trinidad and Tobago, not only for the logistical effort it made in bringing 34 heads of state together in a single place and making it all work, but also in the way in which they managed the negotiation of the summit communique, or final document. Closing a communique and getting to a summit where leaders can actually talk about issues as opposed to talking about text is incredibly important. That did not happen in Mar del Plata, and that's one of the big reasons why Mar del Plata was so contentious and difficult. So the summit process is alive and well. We think also that the Caribbean has emerged as an important leader within the summit process. Before that, the summit process was largely owned by North America and South America. And I think the Trinidadians showed very clearly, with the help of their CARICOM neighbors, that they were capable of managing both the substance of the process and also the logistics. And I think that the introductory remarks that Prime Minister Manning and Prime Minister Barrow of Belize made were especially important, because they were clear-eyed, they were unafraid, and they were looking forward. And I think that set a very important tone that carried through the plenary sessions, as was noted by Ambassador Ramdeen. I also think that the success of other sub-regional groupings between Mar del Plata and the events in Port of Spain actually enriched and enhanced the summit process. And I think they reflect the diversity that exists in the region, but also how you can bring this diversity together into a community. I would also argue that this summit showed that the hemisphere could, for the most part, put away the differences that exist and focus on the broad themes of the summit, which, as you know, were human prosperity, energy security, and environmental sustainability. Again, this has not always been the case in previous summits. Bilateral issues tend to bubble up in unexpected moments and cause tensions between leaders and problems. And that really didn't happen here in the plenary sessions. And I think that was very, very important to creating a larger spirit of dialogue. Even when there were some tough things said, there was a much larger spirit of acceptance. And then finally, I think the hemisphere recommitted itself to its social agenda and expressed its intent, to protect the poorest and most vulnerable countries and the poorest and most vulnerable members of our societies. And given the nature of the crisis and the atmosphere in which the summit was taking place, that was very important. As far as what the summit means to the United States, I'd like to make a couple quick points. First, I think it shows clearly that we're part of the hemispheric agenda, that the United States is part of the hemispheric agenda. And if you look at the kind of initiatives that President Obama announced and that we associated ourselves with, things like the Microfinance Growth Fund, the Inter-American Social Protection Network, the new scholarships announced both for study in the United States and for English language study, the announcement of an energy and climate change partnership of the Americas, a broader commitment to work with our partners in the Americas towards a global climate change agreement in Copenhagen, and also the commitment to ratify CIFTA, the Inter-American Commission on Trafficking in Firearms, Illicit Firearms, our commitment to begin a security cooperation dialogue with the Caribbean, and also our commitment to participate in a public security ministers meeting in the Dominican Republic in October, all showed clearly that we were committed to a broad multilateral process and that we were going to be working with our partners on all the areas that mattered in the hemisphere. I also think that from the point of view of the United States, our participation highlighted a new approach to multilateralism in the region because we explicitly recognized and engaged with sub-regional groupings. The president did not do bilateral meetings. He met with leaders in entities that were identified by the sub-regions themselves. He met with the Central American leaders as SICA. He met with the Caribbean leaders as CARICOM, and he met with the South American leaders as UNASUR. And this was the first time an American president has met with UNASUR leaders, and I think that was an important statement. I also think that we addressed some important outstanding bilateral issues. In regard to Venezuela, there was an agreement to return ambassadors. In regard to Bolivia, Secretary Clinton had a very positive meeting with Foreign Minister Choquehuanca and established a bilateral process that will allow us to identify a new framework for our bilateral relationship with a goal towards returning ambassadors to capitals. And with Ecuador also, I think both President Obama and Secretary Clinton, in their conversations with President Correa and Foreign Minister Falconi, were able to establish a new tone that I think will carry over in a very positive way. And while we recognize that there are differences that need to be addressed between all of these, between ourselves and these three countries, I think we made a very, very good start in Port of Spain, and that this is going to pay us well in the future, because ultimately the Inter-American system is built on dialogue. It's built on the fullest and best diplomatic representation we have. And even in moments of great difference, we have to have this kind of conversation. So we need strong representation in our capitals. And then finally, the president was able to roll out a new approach on Cuba, which is really focused on increasing our links to the Cuban people and enhancing their ability to have a meaningful voice in their future. And then looking for those areas in which we can have a dialogue with the government of Cuba. And this was obviously an important issue at the summit. It will be an important issue in San Pedro Sula at the OAS General Assembly. But I think we've made a good start. In regard to what the summit means for the world, I want to make three broad points. The first is that I think the Americas showed again that this is a region that can coordinate its response to economic crisis in a way that protects our social and economic agenda. I think the second point worth noting is that democracies, especially democracies in different stages of development, can address the causes and consequences of a crisis through dialogue and cooperation. And that finally, the Americas have not sacrificed their integration agenda or their commitment to building a meaningful role for the hemisphere in a globalized world. And in many ways, this might be one of the most important consequences coming out of this summit, because this summit was the first regional summit after the G20 meeting in London. It was the first summit of democracies after the G20 meeting in London. And for that G20 meeting to resonate in a positive way, we had to have a successful summit in Port of Spain. And I think we did. And I think that's vitally important to the United States. I think it's important to the Americas, but also broadly for the world. You know, we have a lot of work in front of us. There's no naivete about that. But I think we've set a positive tone and a substantive agenda that's going to carry us through. And, you know, this is obviously a moment of great challenge for all of us, but it's also a moment of great opportunity. And I would just like to remind all of you present that one of our great secretaries of state, Cordell Hull, the real father of the good neighbor policy, once said that in diplomacy there are no real triumphs or victories. There are only agreements, accords, and accommodation. And ultimately, our success is determined by the degree to which we can all find ways to build partnership. And ultimately, I believe the expression of U.S. power in this hemisphere will be partnership. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Tom. We're delighted to proceed with our distinguished panel. I'd like to invite Her Excellency Glenda Morion-Phillip to address the group.
Thank you, Ambassador de Chasso, fellow panelists, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. I am quite pleased to have been invited to participate in this panel discussion on the theme of the summit, the summit of the Americas process, Port of Spain and beyond. At the outset, I must say that Trinidad and Tobago is very satisfied with the outcome of the fifth summit. And I dare say that we are not the only ones. Not only was this a defining moment for Trinidad and Tobago and the Caribbean, given that it was the first time in the 15-year history of the summit process that it was held in our sub-region. I posit that it will be recorded in history as a defining moment in hemispheric relations. Many a door was opened, and a new dawn was witnessed in energizing old relationships. This was undoubtedly one of the goals we hoped to achieve. In addition to direct benefits anticipated on the national front, Trinidad and Tobago was motivated to host the fifth summit of the Americas by a desire to do three things. One, position Trinidad and Tobago, and by extension, the CARICOM sub-region, into playing a key role in shaping the hemispheric development agenda. Two, shift the emphasis from balancing competing interests to fostering mutual interests. And three, to promote increased cooperation among countries and major actors in the region. With respect to greater cooperation, we believe in the intrinsic value of multilateralism and in cooperation across borders, in finding transnational solutions to transnational problems, and in collaboration with all partners, governments, the private sector, civil society, and development and financial institutions, among other key actors. We believe the fifth summit attained that objective of increasing countries' commitment to work together in the interest of the region's collective benefit. We believe that this was also achieved during the preparatory process and the pre-summit fora, which were held with representatives of civil society, the private sector, labor, the youth, and indigenous. A common thread which surfaced in those interactions was the importance of dialogue and willingness to work together. Mention should be made also of one other group that discussed issues pertaining to the summit, the Interparliamentary Forum of the Americas, FIPA, which has been seeking closer ties with the Organization of American States. And to this end, attended the last two OAS General Assemblies in Panama in 2007 and in Medellin, Colombia in June 2008. I noted with interest the comment in FIPA's PAL Americas newsletter, which said that the Summit of the Americas has become an excellent forum for high-level discussion of the present and future of Latin America. Well, of course, they should have put in the Caribbean, but we'll forgive them for that. FIPA also organized a special dialogue in Port of Spain prior to the summit itself with regional parliamentarians. It would appear that efforts may be made by FIPA to be more involved in future summits, if one is to gauge from the soundings emanating from those quarters. Secondly, the Hemispheric Development Agenda. In respect of the Hemispheric Development Agenda, Trinidad and Tobago and the wider Caribbean, by dint of being the host of the fifth summit, was in the unique position to lay the substantive foundation and the framework for the Declaration of Commitment of Port of Spain, based on the theme Securing Our Citizens' Future by Promoting Human Prosperity, Energy Security, and Environmental Sustainability. You would all appreciate that this theme was introduced in December 2007. And we believe that it was as relevant in April 2009 as it was 16 months ago, and will continue to remain relevant well into the future. We are not, however, immune to existing challenges resulting from the global financial convulsions. The enviable economic gains made by countries in the hemisphere in recent years risk being virtually eroded by this crisis that is eating away at the core sectors on which many of the region's economies depend. The foreseeable future is sobering. Unemployment is expected to continue rising, revenues to decline, access to trade financing and other credit restricted, commodity prices to remain low, and economic growth consequently significantly slowed. Wherever possible, the position of governments of the hemisphere should be that development priorities cannot be sacrificed, be they in the area of health, education, security, the environment, or in the provision of basic services, since such action would ultimately unravel the essence of our democracies. And at this point, one must pause and reflect on Article 11 of the Inter-American Democratic Charter, an important outcome of the Third Summit of the Americas, which all OAS member countries adopted on September 11, 2001. And Article 11 states, democracy and social and economic development are interdependent and are mutually reinforcing. Like all other OAS countries, Trinidad and Tobago fully subscribes to this perspective. So we have a look at the post-summit. The areas addressed in the Declaration of Commitment of Port of Spain, which was itself adopted by all heads of state and government attending the fifth summit, provide several opportunities for the OAS and its member states to pursue projects in the core areas of the thematic pillars, as well as the strengthening of public security, democratic governance, and the Summit of the Americas follow-up and implementation effectiveness, of which Ambassador Ramlin spoke in some detail. The hemisphere has the ingredients to work towards building a society based on shared values and the aspirations of people that transcend borders. There is a commitment to work together with other countries and in collaboration with the institutions of the Joint Summit Working Group, citizens, communities, and civil society in general, in the design and execution of development policies and programs. We have witnessed the candid but respectful expression of positions on the financial crisis, Cuba, bilateral differences, and the challenges that have arisen therefrom, and of course, Haiti. In respect of the latter, we must be heartened by a renewed commitment to address the funding for development programs in that very deserving sister member state. Ladies and gentlemen, the fifth summit has indeed laid the groundwork for strengthening or renewing strong relations between and among our countries and recognition of the need to work together with all our partners in achieving tangible benefits for our countries. President Obama emphasized in his speech at the opening this very concept when he said, "There is no senior partner and junior partner in our relationship. There is simply engagement based on mutual respect and common interests and shared values. I am here to launch a new chapter of engagement that will be sustained throughout my administration," unquote. So that in the face of the changing world dynamics, a change which has been accelerating over the last decade, we've been witnessing a gradual shift in the balance of power in the Western Hemisphere, away from the North towards more South-South cooperation. The larger economies of the Western Caribbean are forging new and stronger alliances. The smaller countries, like the OECS and Trinidad and Tobago, are also seeking to forge closer ties, with Brazil continuing to strengthen its resolve to be an economic and a political force in the Americas, and Venezuela not to be ignored. What does all this say for the future of the OAS as the umbrella under which the countries of the Americas will continue to pursue dialogue as a means of promoting their common goals of securing their citizens' future? To answer this question, I would quote the opinion of President Chavez of Venezuela, as was reported in the Trinidad Express of April 20, 2009. And I quote, "A new atmosphere has been created throughout the continent. The encounter was an entire success that led to a set of tacit commitments and others expressly defined. Of all the summits that I have attended in this decade, without doubt, this was the most successful, one that opened the doors to a new era of reasoning among all countries." And I leave it at that for the time being. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Ambassador. It's my pleasure to ask Ambassador Sarukhan of Mexico to take the podium.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for the invitation. CSIS has a long-held tradition of fostering dialogue between the nations of the hemisphere, so I think this is very timely and very welcome. Thank you for the invitation to be here with you. Time is tyrannical even in a democracy, so I'll try and keep this as short as I can to allow some space for the Q&A at the end. When my dear friend Richard Haass and I were both serving as our respective heads of policy planning in Washington and in Mexico City, I used to badger Richard by underscoring how little attention, how little priority Latin America used to receive from U.S. administrations, regardless of whether they were Democrat or Republican. And Richard would sort of smile and say, well, unless you implode or you declare war on the United States, you're not going to be at the top of our priority list. And at the time, Argentina was facing a severe economic crisis, and I sort of thought and said, well, my dear Richard, not even economic implosion seemed to trigger the type of holistic engagement that some of us would like to see in the hemisphere. And in regards to more dire situations, I told him, remember the classic Peter Sellers film, The Mouse That Roared. Be careful, because if we might end up winning and then we won't know what to do. But I use this because I think we have to be careful. We should not expect sea changes in the way the United States engages with the hemisphere. The United States is involved in the double challenge of Iraq and Afghanistan. The Middle East is still one of the most challenging issues that the foreign policy of this country and of many other countries face. We are facing the potential of a nuclear Iran or a nuclear North Korea and the implications this has for world security. And let's be honest, despite a change of administration, Latin America will still not be a top priority in the foreign policy of the United States. But I think there's some good news. And the good news are that I think that this new administration has come up with a new paradigm to engage Latin America with. I think the profile of the president, his background, his family ties, the fact that he is a community organizer spells good for the hemisphere. I think that in many countries throughout the hemisphere where civil society and NGOs play a vital role in the checks and balances and the vitality of our democracies, having a president who understands a bottoms-up approach, a grassroots-to-grasstops approach in how civil society can be engaged, I think is a very, very positive development. And I think that we will see, hopefully, an increasing holistic commitment by the United States as it engages with Latin American countries. Secretary Clinton's now famous 3 Ds that will frame U.S. foreign policy, defense, diplomacy, development. These are very important issues for the hemisphere. I think that we have seen in many of the potential elements of this new diplomacy, different countries will have different ways to latch on and to work constructively with the United States as the United States starts re-engaging with the hemisphere. And I see a couple of friends of mine who were at a previous speech. I'm now going to baptize them as the Sarukan Posey, because it seems that we've been following each other around for several days in speeches, and they're going to get tired of hearing me saying this. But as we try and ascertain how effective Trinidad has been and what the road ahead for Latin American nations is, I will keep on banging my drum. The most important geopolitical mistake the United States can commit today in its relationship with Latin America is to not ratify the free trade agreements with Panama and with Colombia. This is one of the critical challenges, not only for the U.S. foreign policy with these two nations in the hemisphere, but for all of those nations like Mexico that believe that free and fair trade and market-based economies are one of the best instruments to deliver economic growth and prosperity in the region. How does Trinidad and Tobago play into this? First of all, I will allow me, Madam Ambassador, to join in the previous recognition of the outstanding job that Trinidad did in ensuring that this was both a substantive and logistical success. Pulling summits off is never easy. I think that the feat that Trinidad and Tobago pulled off should be underscored and talked about. Logistically, the fact that we were able to avoid the soap opera that we all saw in Mar del Plata, the last summit, where many of our leaders were enmeshed in less than substantive discussions regarding the challenges of the hemisphere, and the type of dialogue that took place in Trinidad, I think, is a success story in and of itself. I think that the fact that the U.S. administration has proven its willingness to try and move the ball forward in revising a policy which for many of us in the hemisphere, has been ineffectual towards Cuba by trying to effect some change in policy towards Havana by the decisions that the president made before his travel to Trinidad and Tobago is a very welcome development. I think that we were able to talk about all the pressing issues that many countries had without these issues dominating the agenda, derailing the type of discussion that was sorely needed in the Americas with a new administration. I think it was very fortuitous that one of the first engagements for the new president of the United States, along with the NATO summit, was the summit in Trinidad and Tobago. It forced the administration. All of us who've been in government know that when you have a summit, this forces bureaucracies to pay attention and to, you know, push pencil and paper and pen. And I think this was very important that it happened so early on in the administration of President Obama. In many ways, what was also at stake was whether the United States was willing to use what I think is its most formidable diplomatic instrument, its soft power. And in many ways, President Obama was the message. The messenger was the message by the way he engaged with all the countries in the hemisphere, by the way he tried to reframe the discourse. I think that this, in and of itself, was also a success. What are the five priorities that I think that Latin America should focus on with its partners in the region as we move forward from Trinidad and Tobago and take stock of what has happened there? The number one priority is obviously, and more importantly, because of what has gone on in the global economy, economic growth, sustainable development, social well-being. And paramount, as we discuss how trade and social justice and poverty alleviation, where Brazil, Mexico, and Peru probably have three of the most outstanding poverty alleviation programs anywhere in the world, how can all these instruments, whether it's free trade, whether it's poverty alleviation, whether it's microcredit, microlending, how the fulcrum of assets that I think have been developing in Latin America over the past 10 years of sustained economic achievements can be put to bear to ensure that the breach between the haves and the have-nots in the hemisphere is diminished. This is one of the most pressing challenges, and it is at the fore of our agenda as a result of the global recession, which all the countries in the hemisphere are a part of. The second priority is how do we deal with this double conundrum of energy security, energy efficiency, and a green agenda, the challenges of environmental degradation, climate change, which for some countries in the hemisphere not only a dire challenge to their own existence and security because of rising sea levels, but they also entail challenges to the security of our nations. How do we ensure security, access to energy, and also opportunities for economic development? How do we trigger a new agenda for biofuels or alternative means of energy? And I think that both Brazil in its development of ethanol, Mexico in its leadership in international fora, as we try and re-engage with the United States on how we move the Kyoto discussion forward as we head to Copenhagen later this year, I think can play a substantive role in this discussion. Security is the third priority of our region, should be the third priority of our region, not only because I think the hemisphere faces fundamental challenges, non-traditional challenges to security, whether it's proliferation, small arm trafficking, organized crime, whether it's human smuggling or drugs. These are some of the challenges that we have to take on. I stand here today reminding people that this is a critical issue because the way we traditionally went about dealing with collective security in the hemisphere is broken. In many ways, and I remember I was here in Washington and I was with friends from this institution and other institutions and think tanks in Washington who are present here today when Mexico, on September the 7th, 2001, and I underscore the date, went to the OAS to explicitly challenge our nations to rethink the framework for collective security in the Americas. And Mexico's argument was that the structure that we had been bound by, the Rio Treaty, developed in the aftermath of the Second World War, and perfected during the Cold War was no longer relevant to take into account the challenges that we are facing, that the premise of the probability of an extra-hemispheric power invading a country in the hemisphere had diminished to probably nil after the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall, and that we needed to rethink how our countries dealt with new challenges to security, whether it was organized crime, terrorism, or others. And I again underscore the date, September 7, 2001. 4 days after the attacks in New York and Virginia showed how that structure that we had was probably not the type of structure that we needed to be thinking of. And I think that today, given what we're seeing along the Mexico-US border in terms of drugs, of what we're seeing of trafficking patterns in the Caribbean, of how Mexican success in this area is shifting trafficking patterns to other regions of the hemisphere, which until now had not seen significant trafficking patterns, how we deal with small arms in this regard, I think the President's decision to try and ratify CIFTA, an initiative which, by the way, was spearheaded by Ambassador Nnauye, who's here, and many others who signed letters to Senator Kerry and to Congress requesting the Senate to move forward in ratifying CIFTA, is a very, very important achievement. Moreover, our region and our institutions have new models, new paradigms to deal with some of these challenges. The multilateral evaluation mechanism at CCAD of the OAS to try and understand and foster a new paradigm in how we fight drugs based on co-responsibility, based on peer review, should be a model for how we go about fighting drugs and organized crime in the area. The fourth priority is democratic governance. There is a fundamental challenge to liberal democracy in the region today, and we need to take it on. If liberal democracy does not flourish, we will have fundamental challenges to human rights, to transparency, to accountability, to the rule of law in our region. And this should not be an issue that falls off our radar screen. We have to work together to ensure that democratic governance is strengthened in the hemisphere. And finally, how Latin America engages with other regions in the world. And I think that here there are several countries in the hemisphere, whether it's Canada, the United States, Brazil, Mexico, Peru, Chile, that are trying to find new geometries and new architectures in which Latin America can ensure that we are punching at or above our weight in the international system. For countries like ours, and again, I will repeat this, there are only two recipes. You sit at the table, or you're on the menu. If Latin America wants to sit at the table, we will have to engage together in discussing some of the most critical regional and global issues that we face. This is the reason why Mexico is sitting today in the UN Security Council. It is not a coincidence. We did not know who was going to win the elections in November of 2008. But what we did know, and it's not rocket science, is that there was going to be a new government in power in the United States, and that by having Mexico sitting in the Security Council in 2009 and 2010, we were going to have a unique opportunity to engage with the United States in the first 2 years of the foreign policy of whatever president and whatever party won the elections in November. These are the strategic, I think, priorities that Latin America has to focus on as we move forward from Trinidad and Tobago. And let me lastly just mention that there is another challenge which we will at some point have to deal with, which is the hodgepodge of institutions that we have in the region, whether it's the OAS and then sub-regional or regional organizations. We have to come to terms with this Viennese cake of layers and layers of institutions which sometimes are not serving the region as adequately and as properly as they should. And I think that Ambassador Ramdin has just addressed some of these issues of how we can articulate this institutional architecture in the region with the relevance and the importance of the OAS. And I will end my remarks here so we can allow some time for Q&As. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. Minister Councillor Seglia.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Peter Gisazzo. Thank you very much for the CSIS. ladies and gentlemen. Many times I envy here United States, because this kind of the debate, unfortunately, we don't have it in Brazil. Those big events, they are kidnapped by the bureaucracy. The civil society doesn't debate enough. And I'm very happy and honored to be here, and I will try and contribute a little bit for this debate. Excuse me for my English, is not as good as Master Zarukans and Master Randim. I will try to highlight five principal points that we found about this Trinidad and Tobago meeting. First, we think that what happened before the meeting, the choreography, the political choreography that happened before with the Haiti Donors Conference here in Washington, with the very successful trip of President Obama to Mexico, and with the trip of Secretary Clinton to Haiti just before the Trinidad Tobago Summit, we think that it helped very much to generate a climate, a very good climate, for the summit to start. Second point that we would like to make is the expectations of Brazil about the summit were not very high. It was not, we think that Trinidad Tobago authorities and people could handle the summit very well, and they did it very well. We were pessimistic about the idea of it. But we are very satisfied with its results. And especially interesting on our point of view was that, as Secretary Assistant Shannon said, that President Obama showed his commitment for the multilateral approach. So his meetings with the UNASU, CARICOM, and SICA was very important. Why do we think that? We think that because, for example, in Brazil, we don't like to speak about the hemisphere, for example. We like to speak about the Americas, because we're all different. And normally, people north of Rio Grande tend to look south of Rio Grande as a homogeneous amount of countries. And we are different. There are small countries and there are large countries like Mexico and Brazil, small countries. All of them have different agendas and illegitimate agendas. So we think that it was very important that President Obama privileged this multilateral approach. For us in UNASU, it was very important. As you all know, UNASU is a very young body. What we're trying to do, more or less, is what United States did in the 19th century, is integrate the East Coast to the West Coast. We haven't done that yet. As you know, Brazilian population before Brasilia was concentrated on the coast, and we were more looking to United States and Europe and never looking behind us, our neighbors, and the same thing was happening to our neighbors. They were looking to Europe, et cetera. So now we're trying to have a more an integration process. It's very difficult, but we think that the willing of President Obama to meet with the UNASU leaders, it was very important to consolidate UNASU. We are already in UNASU. We already built the Defense Council, and we're trying to put together a drugs council to find common approaches to fight drugs in South America. And talking about also in the Trinidad Tobago, what we liked also is that the United States didn't bring the one-size-fits-all approach for energy, for climate change. That's why we think that, for example, if we don't believe that FTAs are the panacea of the region, if Colombian citizens and government and Panameans believe it's good for them, it's for their interest, and the Americans also do, we think it's fine, it's fantastic. Please sign, ratify, and move on. But in the region, other countries like Brazil, we don't think it's a panacea. Now, and the fourth point that I would like to point out is that even if the absence of Cuba, this anachronic absence of Cuba in the summits was not officially in the agenda in Trinidad and Tobago, the issue was on the table. And as you know, Minister Bruno Rodrigues, in his first trip abroad, he went to Brazil. We talked a lot about this. We're not Cuba's spokesperson. But we believe that Cuba must come back to and has to be accepted back to the Inter-American system. And on a bilateral basis, we're very pleased also that the perspectives of Brazil and United States relations are very good. As you know, President Lula was here in March. Prior to that, Minister Amorim was here and met with Secretary Clinton. And what was most important is that we are going to feel, and we are already feeling, the black backlash of the economic financial crisis. Most of our countries have done a lot of effort these last 20 years to put our house in order, and suddenly this economic financial crisis will hit us very hard. Our countries, we don't have the social net that rich countries may have. So for us, it's going to be difficult. And we believe that United States and Canada could help smallest country to overcome. Brazil is a big country. We'll have a lot of problems, but we have a big market, and we think that we will do a little bit better, well, less worse than others. So I'm very brief, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Minister. Before going further, I'd like to acknowledge the very important role that my colleague, Dr. Johanna Mendelssohn-Forman, played in this event, I'm very grateful for that. I'm sure there are plenty of questions that folks would like to would ask to the panel. If you could please state your name and your affiliation as you ask your question, and perhaps the person to whom you're directing it, please.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Peter. I'm Philip Hughes from the White House Writers Group, and my question is really addressed to all of the panelists, since I think in one way or another they all touched on this topic, but particularly the Minister Counselor from the Brazilian Embassy in his most recent remarks. Cuba was clearly a centerpiece issue at this summit. When the summit process began 15 years ago, of course, the issue of Cuba was also confronted indirectly, in that it was agreed that these would be summits of the democratic countries of the hemisphere. And while democratic practice has frayed a little bit, some would say, in particular countries, maybe Venezuela, we can think of some others, it's nothing in contrast to the prevailing conditions in Cuba, which has had a change of leadership, but not really a change of system. So I just ask the panel generally, what is it that's changed that suddenly makes it so urgent to reincorporate Cuba into the inter-American system?
Not forced, but willing to answer. Why Cuba is now an issue in the hemisphere? Well, I think there are a couple of things which could be reflected on. One is, after 40 years or 40-odd years, you may want to revisit a decision. A decision, if you read the document of 1962, has elements in it which do not exist anymore today. The Sino-Russia threat, as it was mentioned, the Marxist Leninist. Those were two basic arguments for exclusion of Cuba of participating in activities of the inter-American system. So it makes maybe common sense to revisit a document after 40-odd years. That's the first one. Secondly, I think so much has changed over time, and the only member state, only founding member of the OAS, which is not at the table. The flag still flies. The human rights organizations still express themselves on Cuba. In a formal sense, Cuba is still a member of the OAS. I mean, for the institution itself, it is time also to look into how you can bring back unity, collectivity in the hemisphere. So there's a second one. Now, the third one is, which has grown over time, is that almost all countries in the Western Hemisphere, maybe except two or three, do have diplomatic relations with Cuba. And that relationship is increasingly becoming important, not only from the political perspective, but also from the development perspective. If you look at how much Caribbean countries benefit from Cuban doctors and nurses and other kinds of assistance. So, you know, that increased engagement at a sub-regional level between CARICOM and Cuba, between South America and Cuba, Cuba becoming more part of other entities as part of the inter-American system. They are part of the Association of Caribbean States. They are part of, well, the Pan-American Health Organization because of the UN affiliation, but also from Mercosur. So this increased engagement ultimately will, of course, bring the issue to the table. Those are three, four issues which I think makes it very reasonable. And I think when I said just now that the debate is on, I think at the same time we have to say nobody rejects the idea of Cuba's readmission to the OAS at this point. I don't think anybody, including, you know, the U.S. administration, is the way how it is going to be done. That is the question now. Which steps are going to be taken to make that happen?
Thank you very much. Gentleman in the back. Oh, does anyone else like to answer? No? Thank you.
I am Dr. John Mondejar. I work for the U.S. Department of Labor, but I am not asking the question as an official representative of the Department of Labor, but as a private citizen. Ambassador Sarukhan and the other two speakers mentioned the issue of Cuba, which has just been erased. And Ambassador Sarukhan, you mentioned the idea of liberal democracy in the hemisphere and so on. Yet you mentioned that the approach that has been tried with Cuba over the last 50 years hasn't worked. But on the other hand, what about the approach that Cuba has followed with the hemisphere? The responsibility is not just with the U.S. or with the other people. It's also with Cuba. And the fact is that in the early part of the 60s and the 70s, Cuba was just raising problems in Latin America. And people say, well, what about lifting the embargo? Ladies and gentlemen, no country is obliged to trade with anybody. If you trade with somebody, it's because you want to, not because you're forced to. Mexico trades with whomever they want to trade. So the issue is, yes, let's try another approach, but it takes two to make the approach work, not just the U.S., but also Cuba. And if you look at what has happened with China over the last 20 years, we trade, we invest, and everything, but the Communist Party is still at the top in China. So what would lead you to believe that if we open trade and immigration and so on and so forth, what would lead you to believe that the Cuban Communist Party is going to relinquish power? In China, it hasn't happened. So, yes, we have to try new approaches, but we have to be realistic and learn from history vis-a-vis other countries. So it just takes two to tango. That's my comment.
This is a comment, but not a question. All right.
Very well. A question from anyone? Question? Miss?
Hello, Millie Legrain from on behalf of Freedom House. The Mexican ambassador mentioned the importance of working towards democratic governance in the region. I just wanted to ask if this was if democratic governance and the issue of human rights were something that were discussed in depth at the summit.
As the ambassador to the White House, I was not present at Trinidad and Tobago, so I'm not privy to what was discussed, especially in the behind-closed-doors sessions of the leaders. I certainly know that my president, in his conversations, either bilateral conversations or some of his remarks, underscored the importance that for Mexico human rights, transparency, accountability, democracy have for the region, for the development of the region. So for us, it is an important issue.
Well, just basically saying this, having been present in the discussions during the plenary sessions on the second day, many presidents and prime ministers intervened, and they had the freedom to raise any issue. So many of them raised the issue of human rights. Many raised the issue of democratic governance. But I think the principal agenda, which, you know, was almost a consensus agenda, was about the financial crisis, Cuba, and a little bit on Haiti.
I'd like to make a very simple question, put it to the panel. The document of commitment the declaration of commitment that was negotiated before the summit. That is an active working document now for the OAS. Is that considered a consensus document that is the basis upon which the OAS will carry out its mandates?
Yeah. The declaration of commitment was adopted by all the states. And it is a commitment on the part of all the states. So it is a working document. There was consensus in negotiating all 97, was it 97, paragraphs of the document. There was one note by one country on one of the paragraphs. But as far as the effect of the document is concerned, the document is now one of the documents, one of the declarations of the OAS, and on which all governments would base their follow-up action. Or should, I should say. I shouldn't say will. Should. Yeah.
Thank you. My question goes really to our representatives from OAS. But Ambassador Sarukhan, you mentioned the need to address the coordination of the hodgepodge of institutions in the hemisphere. Ambassador Ramdan, you stressed the the need for the OAS to play a stronger role in coordinating the commitments of the summit. But it would seem that the OAS needs itself to be substantially strengthened in order to take on that coordinating role. And I'd ask you, what changes do we need to see at OAS in order to be able to play really the coordinating and the fostering of collaboration role that you're envisaging in the hemisphere? In addition to money, I would say, but.
Thank you very much. I think I would hope everybody would say this because the money part is critically important. So feel free. Now, budget is one issue. In seriousness, the OAS can be as strong as the mandates finance it, as the member states finance the organization. This is an old truce from 1947 when the first Secretary General mentioned this. We can only be as strong as member states want us to be, and budget is a very critical element of that. So increasing mandates, less money, that's not going to work. And when we speak about a summit, it means increasing mandates, and if there are no resources attached to it, it becomes a problem. I do believe that from the perspective of what Ambassador Sarukhan was intimating, plus our own thoughts, that it doesn't work. It is not effective to have different tracks in the Inter-American system doing almost the same thing. And what I mean by that, while we have a summit of the Americas process, legally, it is not part of the Inter-American system. There is no convention, no treaty between the countries saying that we have a summit of the Americas. In a formal sense, the OAS General Assembly is the only institutional arrangement in the hemisphere which can provide mandates, legitimate mandates, legal mandates to the member states and to the secretariat. So basically what we do now is take the summit mandates and bring it in the OAS, and then I think that's duplication, that is waste of energy and a lot of effort. But that's one perspective. So getting more coherence in how we operate in the Western Hemisphere is important. A better relationship between the Organization of American States, which is now at this point only the institutional memory of the process. What we are saying, we should become the secretariat of the process so that we can manage both the organization of a summit, the preparation of a summit, and following up on, you know, the evaluation, what is being achieved or not. Especially where during the summit, Secretary General Insulza spoke on behalf of the 12 joint summit working institutions. So we have already a role within the joint summit working group, which are 12 critical institutions in the Western Hemisphere to coordinate. So it is both institutionally as well as policy to be able to execute policy in a such a way that it is singular and aimed at the same agenda rather than having different tracks doing the same thing. I could expand on this, but this is not the occasion, I believe. Thank you.
Thank you. Johanna Mendelson-Forman, CSIS. I just wanted to follow up on something that Minister Seglia said, and also Ambassador Sarukhan, unfortunately, is leaving, but there are many people that can answer this. You all mentioned multilateralism and the message that this Obama administration says is the way we're going forward, and it's clear with UNASUR and the consultations that went on that this is important. But how do you see this playing out, not in words but in deeds? What will it mean? Mexico and Brazil are members of the G20. There are important implications in the configuration of the world. What practical things do you see that would benefit the relationship of this hemisphere in connecting it with other multilateral processes?
Look, before the summit, we had the United States normally before liked very much to divide our countries. Different decades and or years would privilege one or the other, and this is not productive. We believe that a multilateral approach is a better approach, for especially for a small country who can become stronger if they act multilaterally. I cannot speak about Mexico, but we try in the G20 to represent and to talk for the region. And before the G20, both of the G20 meetings, the Washington meeting and London meeting, President Lula had a lot of consultations with the region. So we try to have this multilateral approach. But we really believe that this multilateral approach of President Obama and Trinidad and Tobago was a very important one. But I would like, I don't know if the person is still here, about Cuba. I'd like to come back, but he left, so. Okay, so.
Johanna, I strongly believe, and I think I should express this, the majority of the problems in the Western Hemisphere are multilateral in nature, are cross-border in nature. We will not solve those problems in isolation. No country alone can do it. Big, small, powerful or not, cannot. We need a multilateral framework, a strong multilateral framework to help solve these problems. We see it at this point in time. The swine flu issue, it's just the best example at this point in time. But we can mention migration, illegal drug trafficking, firearms, almost all the issues, almost all, are multilateral in nature. We need that platform.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm a graduate student from the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut, and we are visiting D.C. for this weekend. And I'm taking this class, Mass Communication and Media, and the role and the influence that the media has in the formation of consciousness in society. I happen to see the summit from two different perspectives, Telesur and CNN. My question is this. What do you think, and it could be answered from many of the panelists, what do you think is the role and how important is the role of the media in this kind of summits, in this kind of dialogue? Are we influence the consciousness of the population by the different media that is the different information and commentaries that are put into the society?
I can give it a try. I will say that the media is essential. In this world, the media is essential. The only difficulty that arises is the message that the media disseminates. There's the problem. For instance, we, in our part of the world, we are small countries, and in particular, Trinidad and Tobago is a small country, and the media would concentrate on only sensational aspects of the process. They leave the substance and just deal with whatever is sensational. And there's where the media has a responsibility, really, because it has a big tool in its hand. So to answer the question, the media has a role to play. The media has a role to play in bringing to other parts of the world what was transpiring at the summit, what decisions are taken. There are serious aspects to it, and the media has a responsibility. That's basically the point I wanted to make.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's thank our distinguished panel.